Glory, I'm going to start with kind of a big question, but it really gets to the heart of your work and your candidacy for president. Tell me how you came to the conclusion that socialism was the answer to the ills of capitalism.
I personally came to the conclusion about socialism being the solution to capitalism when I was in college many years ago. And I grew up in a working-class family, a Mexican mother who was immigrant from Mexico, my father Mexican-American, a postal worker, my mother with the typical immigrant jobs, cleaning house, seamstress in sweatshops. And we suffered what many people suffer today: eviction, foreclosure, lack of money, not enough income, racism. And I realized by going to college that it wasn't just the problems of one family, but the problems of the system. And that's how I became educated, by learning from other activists, learning that how I got to college was affirmative action, that students took over the campus demanding that students of color, that disadvantaged, even white, poor students, be given the opportunity to go into school and have the resources for that. But since then, I've been an activist for many years in fighting the U.S. war drive, from occupations from Iraq to Yugoslavia, the bombing of Yugoslavia, and at home, protesting police brutality and murders, and fighting for workers' rights to a union. I organized a union myself when I was 24. So those are my experiences that convince me, and I will be a lifelong socialist, that the wealth that the workers create, which is everything we consume, use, eat, is made by the workers in collective action. The problem is that it's owned by the wealthy, by the capitalist class, and they determine whether we will work or not, how much we will make in wages, you know, fire us if we try to organize a union. So you have this enormous gap of between rich and poor. Now corporations, in the middle of a pandemic, an unprecedented health crisis, a crisis of economy, things we never imagined before. But you have companies like Amazon making hundreds of billions of dollars and not paying a penny in taxes. That's the state in which capitalism is finding people ground down, more people homeless, and millions at threat of being homeless.
What do you say, Gloria, to the many politicians who would argue for some kind of incrementalism? That, you know, they would say, well, we have elements of socialism in our government now, with government-run public education. There are elements of publicly run health care with Medicaid, Medicare, even though there are private providers, there's a system through the government for those elements of health care. What do you say to that idea that, you know, we're not going to get to socialism immediately, so there needs to be incrementalism toward it?
I completely reject the idea that with time things will get better. In fact, things are getting worse. The reforms that were won in the 1930s and 1960s, whether it's the right to unemployment or Social Security, women's rights, LGBTQ rights, civil rights, they're being eroded. And as the rich get richer and the people begin to protest, begin to demand unions, now there's more interest in unions, there's more repression. And instead of incremental improvement, we're seeing the privatization of education, from the charter schools to right now in the pandemic. Those who can have a quality education are the parents who can afford to have their kids tutored, while many, many children don't even have a computer or internet or even a home to study in. And we see already the Voting Rights Act was debilitated by the Supreme Court. We see women's rights at great threat with the increasingly right-wing Supreme Court and this new nominee, Judge Barrett, who's going to be the key vote in not only taking away women's right to Roe versus Wade and the privacy of our bodies, the right to abortion, but also possibly, very likely, the complete dismantling of the Affordable Health Care Act. And we believe that health care should be free for all. If you even just under the system, if we tax the corporations, the biggest ones, the Fortune 500, at the rate that they should be taxed, there would be plenty of money for free health care, free education, the cancellation of student debt, and financial assistance for families in this time of pandemic. Instead, and I'll say one thing too, the $600 extra that was granted to people for 26 weeks in the pandemic for unemployment and didn't apply to everyone, and many people are still waiting for their unemployment, that $600 extra for those who were averaging maybe $200 in unemployment benefits, that averages out to $20 an hour. And that's what we're demanding, is a minimum wage of $20. I know many young people, I know older people, who were getting that extra $600, and they were telling me, you know, we're finally paying our bills. That should be the minimum income people have. People shouldn't have to work two or three jobs, shouldn't have to have their kids at home with no child care in this time. People should have to have a life of comfort.
Yeah. So, this is a good explanation of some of the policy issues that you are advocating for. But, you know, at the same time, Gloria, I'm sure you're hearing from people who say, look, we have a president who was not the choice of the people. You know, Hillary Clinton got about 3 million more votes than Donald Trump. The same thing could happen to Joe Biden. He might win the popular vote, but lose in the Electoral College. What do you say to people? And I'm sure you've had people pose this question to you before. If you want change, it's you can't split the vote.
Oh, you mean that if we were running, then it would take away votes from Biden?
Yeah, exactly. I mean this of course happened in 2016. There were states, Michigan as one example, where the margin was really close, and there were other candidates on the ballot that received more votes than the difference between the margin of victory between Trump and Clinton.
Well, we don't believe that anybody who votes a third party is being ignorant, and we have to respect people's right to their choice. They don't really have a choice, though, when third-party candidates, especially a socialist like myself, is given virtually no media coverage, will never be seen on national television, because that would be anathema to the idea that you can open up the debate and have someone express ideas like mine of a job being a right, healthcare being an absolute right, and the end of U.S. militarism abroad, shut down all the U.S. bases. They can't have that on TV. So that means that people don't have a real choice.
And I'm sure, Gloria, some people might even argue, to your point, might even argue that the issues that you're bringing up really hurt Bernie Sanders, not once but twice, in the sense that while his candidacy was covered very well, the issues that he was advocating for, some of the same issues that you've mentioned, like health care for all, really did not receive the level of coverage that you might expect.
Before President Obama proposed and the passing of the Affordable Care Act, the common opinion of working class people for many years was, we can't have the government interfere in our health care. It was inculcated in people through TV, through the media, through just living under a capitalist America, that to have government-provided health care meant interference in our right to choose our doctor. But I think it was a great shift in consciousness after the Affordable Care Act, and the idea of the government providing health care has become much more popular. I think that's a trend we have to recognize.
Yeah.
And
well, I mean,
Bernie Sanders was not defeated because of his ideas. He became very, very popular. The problem was that the other Democrats, you know, when you have 25 Democrats running, and then right before Super Tuesday, they conspire against him, boy, joining up, and finally supporting the man who was running almost dead last, Joe Biden, who has not inspired people right now.
Yeah.
I think what's giving him his possibility to win is a great fear of Trump running and winning again.
Okay. So let me ask you, in terms of taking an approach looking to the future, last year the city of Las Cruces started using ranked choice voting for its mayoral election. And this year, as you know, Maine becomes the first state in the country to use ranked choice voting in the presidential election. More states are using ranked choice for certain races. Is this the answer to the United States getting more than a two-party system in government?
The electoral system and the fact that overwhelmingly the power in politics lies in the Democrats and Republicans means that much more will have to happen to bring real change in this country. I think it will be outside of the political arena, the electoral arena. Why? Because
now, what does that mean? I mean, in other words, you're saying ranked choice is not going to do it. You're saying that there has to be essentially some sort of protest movement to overtake what we're seeing now?
I think ranked choice is an important reform to call for. I think I certainly wouldn't be against it. But honestly, the United States is distinct from countries like Western Europe, where the parliamentary system, where it's possible to have parties have some sort of role, minor parties have a role and even coalesce with others in parliament. But the United States is a unique entity in the electoral arena. You have two parties that represent the most powerful economic and military system in the world of capitalism. And they're holding on to that power dearly. I don't think that we're getting more rights in elections. We're getting less. You also have some 35 million people, adults of voting age, who are denied by being either undocumented workers or permanent residents, of which are 17 million, and 5 million people who are in prison or live in states where if you are on parole or probation or even permanently denied the right to vote. I think it's getting harder and harder to have voting rights. So you're talking 35 million people who are permanently denied the right to have a voice in the election, and that's deliberate. I do not think that the Democrats or Republicans want to legalize immigrants or make it easier for people who live here or youth under the age of 18, between 16 and 18, who I think should have the right to vote, because they represent a demographic that wants more justice.
Yeah.
And then to police brutality.
Oh, I mean,
better wages.
I think if we look at polls, that absolutely agree with you. And in 2018, we saw more young people vote. We did see a lot of change in Congress. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, among a group of very progressive Democrats elected. There are hopes for even more in 2020. So here's the question. I mean, how do you think young people and more people who do not vote in general can be made to care about public policy and get involved and go vote?
I believe that there's still a great deal of cynicism about the elections, but I think that what could have been seen among youth as a certain complacency has been stripped away by the recent years of protest. And the greatest numbers of people in the streets bringing justice to the victims of police murder and police terror are the youth, black and white, and other youth of color. But the youth together defying the repression of the police, defying threats by President Trump, peacefully marching and saying, we can't tolerate this anymore. But it's also bringing forth other ideas of socialism. In my party, the Party for Socialism and Liberation, our numbers have grown greatly. and our party is overwhelmingly young people with a high sense of consciousness and principles, dedication, who are learning quickly in the streets what it means to have popular power, the power to change things that would seem like never would change. How many thousands of people have been murdered, black, Latino, and others, have been murdered in the last years with no action, no justice, no prosecution of the police? Now we're seeing police being prosecuted. There's still not enough. We need someone like Breonna Taylor, who was brutally gunned down in her bed, to have justice, because people, you can't live like this where black people have to fear their son or brother, father, walking outside, or women as well, or even being home. Botham Jean, Breonna Taylor. And so these are the kind of things that may not resonate among the higher-ups in both parties, Democrat and Republican, but they mean a great deal to the people in the black community, the Latino community, especially New Mexico, where there have been such a high number of young Latinos murdered.
Well, and, you know, earlier you mentioned that the lack of media coverage of some of these issues means that we don't have the kind of progress we should. In the issue you just mentioned, there's been enormous media coverage, and there has been some change, not everywhere, but in some places. So connecting the dots there, one might argue that media is a big part of the issue in terms of moving toward change. I want to get to another issue that I think is really important to talk about, and this goes beyond the media into things that we hear politicians say. You know very well about this. I'm sure you've dealt with this personally, that the words socialism and liberal are used by some politicians as pejoratives, and they're used to attack. How do you work against that kind of a narrative?
I think the process of the impoverization of the working class, when you consider long before the pandemic hit, federal statistics showed that half of the population is officially poor or near poor. And I would say the percentage is larger, because the official statistics means a family of four, $25,000. But you could have double that income and still be poor, because you have to pay health care. Your housing costs may be too high, your education costs for your kids. So anyway, I think that the economic situation of people is making everyone question. Especially with Bernie Sanders' campaign, where he spoke as a socialist, saying he's a democratic socialist, and raising ideas like free health care, cancel student debt, free public education, and so many other, you know, progressive ideas. These resonate with working class people. Someone is finally saying something in a larger stage, something we would be able to say, and even more, like no war. Like shut down all U.S. bases abroad. That's what we would call for.
So it sounds like, in a nutshell, I mean, one of the things that you think will get us there in terms of people understanding the plight of so many Americans, even if they're not experiencing this situation themselves, is education. Essentially, telling people, look. We have, here's the crisis we have. Here's how many people do have to make that choice between paying for health care and paying rent and food.
Oh, yes. I think that most working class people are invisible in the political arena. Mm. When you hear Biden and Trump talking this horrible show of the debate the other night, they never spoke about people's needs. They never really addressed the problems that people are facing. It was just a fight, you know, mostly carried out by Trump and his absolute rudeness. But they will not address, for example, the issue of military spending versus domestic needs. The budget is supposedly $750 billion. It's really closer to $1 trillion because the nuclear war industry is not counted in the Defense Department budget.
Yeah.
It's in the Department of Energy, We should know that very well in New Mexico.
And we rarely see reporting on that. I mean, you mentioned this number, $750 billion every year on the military budget. But when that's reported, normally that we don't get the context. In other words, that here's how much that money could do in terms of healthcare, in terms of education, etc. So it's sort of just a number out there. It doesn't mean much to a lot of people.
Well, the burden, think of this, of the enormous burden on the working class, the middle class. You know, most people who are not capitalists, people who depend on a job for a living, basically, or people who are disabled and get an income. Not only do we pay taxes that fuel the military budget, but the military contractors are the ones who make the profit. We suffer in the ways also of extra taxes. The politicians like to say, oh, we're against taxes. We're not going to tax you. Oh, yes, you will, because you give tax breaks to the rich. And people are fooled by this kind of stuff. I don't think they're going to be fooled much longer, though. Mm. And then there's other taxes like parking tickets or increased fines in city services or shut off cutbacks in city services or federal or state services. The burden is falling heavier and heavier on the working class, while the rich are amassing obscene, untold wealth at our expense, low wages. We pay taxes, but we get no health care. We don't have a right to affordable housing when we retire. And the Social Security income that people depend on, mostly solely their income, is not enough to survive. And so when you retire, people are desperately poor, having to go to Walmart in their old age. Yeah. And so I think people are feeling fear, insecurity, wondering how is this going to change. I think they felt some hope with Bernie Sanders and others. I saw this year that more people were interested in Warren because they might have liked more what Sanders was saying, but they thought she was more electable because Bernie Sanders was painted as not electable, or because he's too radical. Yeah. And so people are conditioned to vote against themselves and act against themselves. I've seen that before. Well, I live in California. I'm from New Mexico. But in 1996, when there was a single-payer health care plan on the ballot, 77% of the voters voted against it. Because remember I said before the Obama care, people thought that a government plan was bad for them. Now they know it's not so bad.
Yeah. Well, and since you mentioned Bernie Sanders, of course, now Bernie Sanders has moved to working to elect Joe Biden as president. And I want to ask about this moment in time, because in addition to the policy issues that you've talked about so eloquently today, you know, as you know, Bernie Sanders is talking about another issue, and that is his contention that we're in grave danger beyond policy in terms of President Trump as the person in the highest office in the land. His contention that this moves the country to a very dangerous point where we may even lose fundamental norms that we've all kind of taken for granted, and even the very nature of having an election. In other words, he's already repeatedly saying that essentially that the election results won't be they won't even be legitimate unless he wins, unless Trump wins. What is your assessment as we close about the threat, about how serious this threat is?
I think it's very worrisome, and I'm concerned also by the dog whistling of President Trump. of his call the other day to the so-called Patriot Boys, this neo-fascist organization saying stand back and stand by. He's obviously desperate to win and is calling on what he considers his solid, solid base, the extreme right wing, the ultra-racists, as well as the bankers, a good section of who are behind him at this point. But in reality, when you look at the political process in the United States, the repression has grown. It was under Obama that it was revealed that every individual in the United States is having their phone conversations recorded, listened to. The surveillance against a possible uprising of the people, against all this economic injustice. We're seeing growing militarism by both parties. They both vote for the war budget. They vote for the bombing and the repression of the Palestinian people. And right now you hear Joe Biden and the Democrats demonizing China. It's called this great power competition against China and Russia. And we're being fooled into thinking, oh, Russia elected Trump. It's this diversion it's to divert people's attention from what's really at hand, that the capitalists are getting richer, that they're amassing a great fortune, that the Pentagon that acts in their interest wants to do things like carry out more military coups, for example, against President Maduro in Venezuela, because that country has the largest source of oil in the world, because the U.S. State Department, the whole ruling class of this government, believes that China should not be able to have to be an economic competition. That's why you have Trump imposing sanctions. Rather than developing the economy of the United States, they're trying to quell and crush China's economy, which is a socialist country. And you have the U.S. blockading Cuba horribly, while Cuba's doctors are all around the world providing health care and helping people survive the COVID pandemic. People don't even know in this country that the U.S. is blockading Cuba from having essential food and medicine and other needs that a country needs, trying to crush a country because it is socialist, because it does have free health care, because nobody is evicted. There are no landlords in Cuba. Everybody has a home. These are the things of socialism that the government, both Democrat and Republicans, don't want us to know about. We, in our campaign, are using this electoral arena to educate the people that we need to organize, mobilize in defense of our right to a decent life, to a job or an income, to health care, schooling, and social peace, full equality, which we can have when the people are in power.
Okay. Gloria LaRiva, thank you so much for being with us today. We appreciate it.
Thank you.